I'm full shook up, and I hope maybe if I make some errors or whatever, stutter some, I can forgive me.
You'll be okay.
Welcome, everybody, and I thank you so much for inviting me to this auspicious event. This doesn't happen too often, but it was great to be among all of you, have something in common, which is really, really a great, great thing. So I'll get started. I enlisted in 1943, and I went into New Cumberland, Pennsylvania. And there were several busloads of us, and we went into one end of the building as civilians, and when we left the other end of the building, we were GIs. And not only that, but we had a half a dozen people with needles that were just excited to get us. They did. Yeah. And so anyway, after a little bit, we moved from there and went by rail to Camp, what was then Camp Campbell, Kentucky, now Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And I liked it very much, right? Especially all that cloud of dust that would go up when a vehicle would go driving by. But anyway, as it turned out, I was lucky in that I had volunteered to be drafted, and a number of individuals were called up at the very same time, and it just so happened the Army was standing up and organizing a signal battalion. And lucky for me, I wound up in the Signal Corps, and consequently, I put 20 long years in the Signal Corps. But at any rate, being in the Signal Corps kind of kept us guys from getting shot at too often. And so anyhow, we learned to splice wire and cable, clamp poles, and do all of the things associated with communications. And we were there, and finally I wound up in the 39th Signal Company. And the 39th Signal Company was a unit that supported the 26th Infantry Division with all of the various kinds of communications. So we did a great, great job on and on. So before you know it, we were out on the field, in the field on maneuvers, and after another round of that, we wound up in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And from there, we went to Camp Shanks, New York. And we deported on 26th of August by way of the Liberty ships. And I don't know if you know about Liberty ships or not, but they built a number of them during the war, and some of them were done to deep freeze on to those German submarines. But we had about 1,500 guys in our ship, and you can imagine the logistics involved, you know, to feed all of us only two meals per day. But at any rate, I for one was nervous about submarines all the way, and our convoy consisted of maybe 6 or 8 different ships, and ours, with all the folks in it, were kind of in the middle of the convoy. So we ultimately we landed at Cherbourg and Utah Beach, and that happened to be on the 7th of September. I was one of them that landed at Cherbourg. And we crawled down the net, got in landing craft, and they hauled us into a mesh that was put into the sand to support vehicles and troops as well. And once we got to that point, then we hiked up the beach for about a half a mile or so. And ultimately, we wound in a thing called Anyway, it was an area that was set up, you know, in and away from the beach area, you know, to have a place to be, you know, until they got ready to move forward. Sorry about getting all shook up. As we were coming up the gangplank there, this individual in our weather team saw an individual that was a high school friend of his. This high school friend was a member of the Seabees, and he had been on D-Day on the beach Pastor Seabee, they had been in there earlier on and underwater, and went and crossed the mines that the Germans had put down there to be plugged to work, you know. And you can imagine how many lives were saved because of that work. And he was telling us how all of the different ships that were hit, and individuals and gear and everything all over the beach area, and then it's in the water as well. And ultimately, grave registration people had to be there. And in the first 2 months of the battle that ensued in and around that area, there were 34,000 individuals that had been buried by the grave registration. So that was quite a sum of people that lost their lives there. And the Germans obviously knew that we were going to attack them sometime. And so they had put these mines down in other areas as well. And they also put like poles that they buried in the ground that had them upright. And the purpose and the object of all of that was to keep these glider troops that would come in there, you know, under without power and land, and they would be plowing into all of them poles, and a lot of individuals were killed and a lot of damage done because of all of that. Another thing that was there is the French had these hedgerows, thick, deep, and tanks were unable to penetrate. And when they plow into the hedgerow, the tank would kind of go up into the air, exposed in the bottom of the tank, perfect targets for the gunners of the Germans. And some good thinking individuals decided something had to be done, and they went and built and formed blades like akin to what would be on a bulldozer, and attached them to the bottom of those tanks, and then down close to the very bottom. And so then when the tank went into that hedgerow, it would take the doggone all of that growth and everything and plow it out of the way, and thereby being able to get through. And of course, here again, when that was completed, another time saving a whole lot of lives, obviously. And then once that happened, the war moved on. And this is, I got this information kind of from a hearsay basis, but it was St. Lo. I don't know if any of you ever heard of that place or not. But the Germans had built like tunnels and put artillery down in there, put them on hydraulic lifts. And so they would obviously have spotters. And anytime our troops started and tried to move, them doggone Germans had popped them artillery pieces on up, and so we were unable to move forward. And this again called for some good thinking and quick work. And so they went and rounded up every artillery piece that was in the area, whatever size was immaterial. And they set them up on a time on target basis. And they were also, all of them were equipped with the device in the unit, in the artillery round, that was sending out a signal. And when that come within a solid object, it would explode. And this then was causing aerial bursts. And I don't know if any of you have been around and seen aerial bursts, but they do a lot of damage. And so this is what they did. They got all of that set up, and when they fired, every piece fired such so that it was synchronized, and each piece had their own target, so that they were synchronized and would arrive on target at the very same identical time and explode. And then this happened again and again, a multitude of rounds, salvos that they threw in there on the Germans. And finally they decided, chances are they'd be able to move forward, and sure enough, they were able to do just that. And this then opened up back road, and I linked that ditch, which had been, you know, closed off. And this is when the Red Ball Express came into being. The armed forces obviously needed supplies and ammunition and fuel and you name it. And I'm sure you maybe read history or know about it, but the war had come to an end because of the lack of fuel and ammo. And so once that road opened up, the Red Ball Express started in delivering supplies. And I have down here that, okay, they went around to nearby units and rounded up all their trucks, rounded up a bunch of men and trained them to drive. And you can imagine how things were back then. There were no automatic transmissions. There were no synchromesh transmissions. We're talking about double clutch. All of them guys that had been rounded up, that knew nothing about any of that, took quite a bit of training. And so, as time went on by, they got organized, and they wound up with close to 600 vehicles that were in that operation. They were driving and hauling materials for 83 days duration, and delivered close, or maybe a little in excess of 1 million tons of supplies and food and you name it, whatever all, you know, you can imagine what all a military unit would need to fight a battle. This is what they were hauling. And my outfit, the 39th Signal Company, rode up to where they dropped us off, where we were going to be situated on the Red Ball Express. And they never wasted any time. When they got there and dumped us out, they were on their way of getting out of there, because at that time we were within artillery range. And so, yeah, it was always a dangerous situation. So anyway, on the during the interim period, I imagine every one of you have heard General George Patton. Okay, he was our Third Army commander. General Paul was our division, 26th Infantry Division commander, and Colonel Scott was the 101st Regiment. And General Patton set up his headquarters in Nancy, France, which was beyond St. Lo, quite a bit. And on one of those days, we were out working our wire, and here comes General Patton with his armored car, troops inside of it that were his bodyguards. He was riding in his Jeep. He would not be belittled to get into that armored car, no way. That would be cowardice. And guess what? He went right by there. You heard about his pearl-handled pistols? I saw them. I saw those pearl-handled pistols on General Patton. Yes, I did. He was a general that was fighting a war to win. And I don't know that one could say that about maybe all of them, but especially once things got along a good way, so seemed like there didn't seem to be a great urgency anymore, but not Patton. He would not slow down. But finally, they relieved us out of the line, and we wound up in Metz, France. And of course, we had a string wire. And this day, I was up in a tree, tying off a wire, and suddenly, zoom! And I thought, oh no. And I knew exactly what it was. I never heard the shot, but I knew the sound. And I bailed down out of that tree, and there was a concrete wall there for flood control. And after I collected my wits, I come to realize that some individual had just got through trying to kill me. And here I was, a 19-year-old boy. I thought it was way too early for me to die. But those of us that were in that work climbing every time we got off of the ground, we realized that we were always a target. Anytime you had to get off of the road, you were potentially going to step on a mine as well. This is always present. On the 8th of September, our first attack took place, and we went forward going all over and down a long, long gradual hill. The Germans were up on the hillside, Hill 310, by the way, and they could see us coming and know what was going on, and they took advantage of that, and there was quite a bit of debris along the road. And we finally got into the town. The name of the town is Mooienvik. And it had been shelled from both sides, back and forth. There were no intact buildings, no intact roofs. And we found the cellar and got down in it. But the Germans were throwing in that artillery again and again, and they would slam into wherever, and you could hear that shrapnel ricocheting all over the doggone place, and it was scary to say the very least. And right in the midst of that, the warrant officer, signal officer, came to our cellar and said, "Our radio equipment is not working. We have to get one of your lines back in service." And it was my turn to be out troubleshooting. And we got out of that doggone doorway, out of that cellar, and I started in praying, and I was sure that I was not going to be alive the next day. It was horrendous, scary. Patrols, you run into patrols and you didn't know who was who. Nobody seemed to know what the password was. it was a bad, bad time. And I can only say this and be truthful about it. It was just an unbelievable exercise in fear. You know, it was just unbelievable how that was. But we finally managed to get it completed and handed the telephone to the colonel and said, "Here it is, you know, do your talking real quick." And we got down in the cellar, and luckily it stayed in for a while. And the next day, the sergeant and the officer went looking for another place away from there, because that was a dangerous place to be. And they decided we were going to stay in a doggone farm area, you know, with animals that had been killed and everything. And while they were there talking about it, surveying the place over, the Germans from Hill 310 lobbed some mortar rounds in there, and the rats were unbelievably bad and scared the heck out of all of us. They pulled the cover up over our heads to keep them at bay, but nonetheless, they were there. And rats, as you well know, are poisonous. And from there, we moved forward and moved into this little town on the edge of the town. But before we got there, the road took a great big long bend. And so we pull our wire across there instead of going around, and over our truck backed into the field area were two vehicles that hit mines. Somebody had told us all they had swept for mines, but maybe they had, but they didn't get them all. And when we got through with our truck, we pulled out, and the other vehicle that was helping us out backed in that same track. When he went to pull out, he stalled the truck, and it rolled back. When he went to pull forward, that doggone truck lifted up in the air about 6-8 feet high, spun around, and come down on the ground. And I knew it was a mine, and I went running back. There was 4 men in the back, and as luck had it, none were killed. They could have easily been killed. But the one individual had just basically lost his right leg, and one other individual come battling out of the back of that truck, running up through this town, hollering, "Medics, help, help!" Out of sight. 60 years later, on a get together in Denver, Colorado, reunion. He showed up and wanted us to tell him exactly what happened on that day. He wound up in a hospital somewhere, didn't know where he was, didn't know how he got there. And I think God had to be with us a lot of the time, no doubt about it. Because just about the time, a Jeep pulled up, and there was a doctor in that Jeep. And of course, I'm sure all of you know the fact that we didn't have penicillin back in those days. We had sulfa powder and sulfa drugs. Yeah. And I was pretty excited, to say the least, and so I kind of went up on exactly what all was going on. But this medical officer, this doctor, went and put a splint on his leg, and they put him in the back of our truck. And the driver was driving, and I was in the back with him and asking him, you know, is your leg hurting? And the leg that was blown away, there was nothing there to hurt, but his opposite leg was paining him, he said. And we're going back through on a dirt road, bumping, bump, bumping. He started then sweating and turning pale. And I am thinking, he's dying. He's going to die. Please, Lord, don't let this guy die. I don't want him to die here with me, kind of trying to watch over him. But we finally got back to the aid station and hustled up some medics, and they just took care of him. And you have to remember, we didn't have helicopters then, and I don't have a clue maybe where the nearest facility would have been that could have taken care of him. Maybe in Nancy, France, which was maybe close to 100 miles away or so, I don't know. But to this day, I've tried and checked with other individuals to see if anyone might have ever had a clue as to just what did or did not happen. But I've never had any luck, so there's no doubt in my mind that leg had to be amputated. I mean, it was just barely hanging by a few shreds. Yeah, and it was quite a frightful event, to say the least. Anyway, we got through that, and after a while, we pulled off the line, and we wound up in Metz. And we had a string wire. The regiment needed wire, so we had to provide communications. And here I am up in a tree, tying off a wire, and suddenly, ding! And holy crap, what was that? And I knew, in that moment, I knew what it was. Somebody had shot. And I bailed down out of that tree and hit the ground. And when I got my wits back together, I am thinking, sure enough, someone was trying to kill me. And of course, those of us that were in the climbing world, you know, stringing wire, any time we got off of the ground, we were potential targets. And anyhow, it was a dangerous occupation. And then, before long, the Battle of the Bulge broke out. And we drove all night up into Luxembourg, Metz. And that day, there's aircraft flying all around. And one of ours that we thought was ours, a P-47, strafed a convoy, and we had to put marker paper on our vehicles so that enemy, our pilots, would know who we were. And it didn't seem to matter, because this P-47 strafed that convoy and killed their commander. And there were just planes flying around, and I, for one, was always looking for a place to get to, you know, be safe. But it was the beginning of that doggone revolt. And not far from where we were at, Germans had overrun a bunch of our installations, and not far from our location, they had captured 84 of our men. and had lined them up and murdered every one of them. And we heard about that, and we're thinking, you know what, we're not that far away from where all of this took place. We could have been on the receiving end of that doggone thing just as well as not. But we didn't, and we were okay. So we moved forward to another location, and during that time, though, our fuel kitchen set up and prepared a great turkey dinner for all of us. What a great, great thing out there in the field. Yes, yes. And at first you have to understand, all the while we were within artillery fire range and aircraft range. It never knows that you think it's being in the same place unless you wind up in the cellar. But as we went forward, here determined MB-109 over in the field. Undamaged. So I don't know if this individual was really smart and decided he wasn't going to give his life for Hitler, or if he indeed lost power and went dead, sticked in there, you know, and got out of the craft and got away, and ultimately maybe turned himself in and was saved. His life was saved because of all of that. And I decided I wanted a souvenir, so I took a hacksaw and went in there and hacked off a piece of the propeller. And I brought that along home. I had it, just gave it to a friend of mine just here recently. He's going to make a doggone bell buckle out of that. Yeah. And then we moved up farther, and we moved into this farm village called Mercer Dunkirk. And we were in, and it was bitter cold. And you have to understand, Arctic gear was something that was unheard of. There were no muckalucks, there were no heavy gloves, none of that, none. And we had these doggone leather boots, and you know what a leather boot will do in this bitter cold weather here. It don't protect you. That was where we were. And so we had to be out at night and do our own guard duty because of the infiltration potential. And we had set up where we were required to put some of this, maybe you heard of some of this paper that they had during World War I that would detect poisonous gas. We had to put that on our uniform as an identifier. If you didn't have that on, you were one of the enemy. Yeah. And we're in this building, and we made the family go to the cellar. We had to leave there for a few days when we go back. The team that had been there didn't make them go to the cellar. The artillery round hit the roof of the building, drove a piece of shrapnel down into the building, hit and killed their 5-year-old daughter. And they were so sad, and so were we. And when we come back, I said, if you would have only been here, you always made us go into the cellar, but we thought it was okay. But that didn't bring your daughter back. We were close enough on that occasion where an anti-aircraft unit, the type that has multiple 50s in one gun, up on the hilltop, within sight of where we were, you could see the tracer bullets and all of that kind of thing. And we were near. It was a scary, scary doggone time in our lives, to say the very least. But anyway, finally the weather cleared, and the Air Force was able to bail all of the individuals that had been entrapped up there in the vault and drop supplies and food and all of the items that were needed. And the weather cleared up to a point where the pilots and the aircraft were able to fly and see. And so the Germans naturally caught heck. And this helped to bring that doggone conflict to a whole lot quicker end. But ultimately, that did happen, and so here we are moving forward, and ultimately we cross the Rhine River. So we're out in Germany now, in flatland, and not too long, we come upon maybe like 2,000 prisoners that had been marched all the way down from Poland by the Germans. And they were allowed a cup of water soup per day to survive on. The SS troops were following up the proceedings, and anyone that went down and couldn't get up, you can imagine what happened to them. They shot them in the head and killed them. And there were some Englishmen in the group, and we were hoping maybe that they were able to point out the individuals that were responsible for that. You know, you never know. In war, you don't have time for niceties. You know, you got to be doing what you have to do. And so anyhow, on forward, and ultimately, our unit wound up in Czechoslovakia, covered all that territory. And we were there a little while, and I forget which day in May, 6th, 7th, 8th of May or so, the war had come to an end, and we witnessed maybe 5,000 Germans that surrendered. And the reason they surrendered is because they didn't want to wind up being under control of the Russians. And of course, I have to say this one thing. General Patton, you know, could have, if been allowed to, could have walked through with our forces probably without a shot being fired. But somewhere in the bureaucracy, they had agreed that the Russians were going to be allowed to take Berlin. And as a consequence, that doggone Tri-City thing evolved, and the great big wall that was there for all of that time evolved. And untold people were killed because of all of that. But yeah, it was the Russians and the communists are bad, bad people. Don't ever want to think anyone wants to believe or think that communism is dead. Communism is not dead. You can be sure of that. And the only reason they haven't done us in is because they've never figured out how they could do that. Anyway, I think maybe I run out of time. I don't know, but I hope I didn't stutter too bad. But I think I kind of gave you a bulk of what I had down here. But it was exciting to say the least. It's scary at times, and so I'm glad I made it through all right. And as luck had it, I was uninjured. So thank you so much.
Newly formed Air Force. He had a rank of termination and was given approval to keep his rank as sergeant. He enlisted into